This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 24th of April 2010 here in Japan, and it is the 23rd in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by Jim Mars, an author and researcher who cut his teeth as a newspaper journalist in Texas. His seminal 1989 bestseller Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy, was a basis for Oliver Stone's JFK film. His other books include The Alien Agenda, Rule by Secrecy, The Terror Conspiracy, and The Rise of the Fourth Reich, The Secret Societies That Threatened to Take Over America. Jim Mars, it is a pleasure to have you on the program today. Thank you for joining me.
Well, it's my pleasure, James, and a big old Texas howdy to all of my readers in Japan.
Excellent. Well, Jim Mars, your work does cover so much ground that it's difficult to know where to begin a discussion like this, but perhaps we should start today by mentioning that you are going to be one of the keynote speakers at a conference that's being held in Santa Cruz on the weekend of May 14th to 16th. And the conference is called Understanding Deep Politics and will feature speakers such as former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney and 9/11 researcher David Ray Griffin and MI5 whistleblower Annie Michon and many, many others, including the man who coined the term deep politics, Peter Dale Scott. So, Mr. Mars, tell us a little bit about the conference and what you'll be speaking about.
Well, at first, I thought this was going to be another 9/11 conference, and I think that's certainly going to be talked about. But what I find most interesting is that actually this is going to go way beyond 9/11. It's going to get into all of the, as they call it, deep politics of the United States. So it's going to be a very, very interesting conference. The other thing that really intrigues me is that I know in my talk, and I understand, and several of the others, we're not only going to be talking about all the bad things that's happening in the United States, we're also going to be talking about what can we do about it, and what can we do to make things better, not only for the United States, but for the rest of the world.
That is absolutely such an important thing to focus on, rather than simply focusing on what we're opposed. We need to also positively construct what we're in favor of. So I agree with that completely. But I understand that the term deep politics was coined by Peter Dale Scott as a way of counteracting that inevitable conversation-ending label of conspiracy theory. And I'm sure the conspiracy theory label is one that you have encountered numerous times in the course of your career. Do you prefer to use terms like deep politics, or do you have another label for what you're doing, or do you not pay much attention to the semantics at all?
Well, of course, it's interesting. One of the few good things to come out of the attacks of 9/11 is that the term conspiracy has kind of been rehabilitated, all through the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Anytime myself or anybody else tried to talk about conspiracy, the corporate control mass media scoffed at it like no conspiracies happened in the United States. And, of course, that's ridiculous because all through those decades, there were many, many people put in prison, convicted of conspiring to do something, especially mafia and criminal types. So, but after 9/11, which after all, any way you want to look at it, even if you accept the official version, it was a big conspiracy. Now, the thing that kind of bugs me is that myself and others are called conspiracy theorists. Okay, in other words, like we're just making up some theories, out of whole cloth. Well, my line is, James, if you can prove something, it's not a theory. And so I prefer to say that I deal in conspiracy facts.
That's absolutely true, and I think anyone who has read your writing know that you have incredibly detailed and documented facts and assertions rather than theories. And I'm going to admit that I only very recently read your book Crossfire, which is such a landmark book in the history of JFK research, and I think it really should be read by anyone who wants to have an opinion on the JFK assassinations. One of the things that struck me about that book was how the deep state or the shadow government or the secret team or whatever term you want to apply to it is able to so thoroughly control the dissemination of information that they are able to effect a grand cover-up on a massive scale and then to ridicule anyone who questions that cover-up. And I would assume that it's your position that nothing essentially has changed in that regard in the last 40 years.
Unfortunately, no. In fact, I'm not quite at liberty to talk about it at this point, but in a couple of months, I will tell you about my own experience with censorship. And you have to understand, the key censorship in the U.S. corporate media is not so much that they lie about anything. No, generally they're presenting the truth, but it's what they leave out. It's what they don't tell you about. In fact, that's what actually, I guess, prompted me to write Crossfire, is there had been several books already out, and there had been, of course, TV specials. But being in Texas, being in the Dallas area, I knew that there was just an abundance of factual information that had not been told to people. There were witnesses, good witnesses to the assassination, who had never been talked to, either by the official investigations or by the so-called watchdog news media. And so I simply accumulated all the information that I could gather and put it into my book, Crossfire. And I tell people all the time, if you want to start and really learn about the Kennedy assassination, then the first thing to do is read the Warren Commission report. Because what they say generally is very factual. But then the problem, again, is not what they say, it's what they don't say. So then read my book, Crossfire, and you'll fill in the gaps. And then you'll be able to get a better picture of the mosaic that forms the true picture of the Kennedy assassination.
That is so true, and it's so well documented that there really is not much room to dispute that book, and that's what I loved about it so much, is that it just takes facts and piles them one on top of another, on top of another, on top of another, and it starts to form an overwhelming narrative that paints a very different picture than the story we've all been told, and we all seem to subconsciously understand the cover-up version of those events, but we don't know why we believe that, or we don't know how the idea has been implanted. It just has sort of taken on a life of its own over the course of the decades. And it's very interesting to watch how that took shape. And one of the many aspects of that cover-up that I found particularly interesting was the way that key witnesses and key people involved in the investigation ended up dying in mysterious and unexplained circumstances, like DeMorin Schultz, who died the day that the House Select Committee was coming to interview him, and many other instances like that.
Yeah, very convenient. And by the way, of course, according to the official version, he committed suicide with a shotgun. I spent a lot of time with his wife, Jean DeMorin Schultz. And one thing she stressed to me over and over and over was that she could believe that George might have been driven by some circumstances to suicide, but that he would have never used a gun because he abhorred guns. He hated guns. He never would have used a gun. And I always found that very interesting. And, of course, I've been called to task because they say that in Crossfire I talk about all the mysterious deaths. Well, no, I didn't call them mysterious deaths. Some of them are probably legitimate accidents, legitimate health problems, but I called them convenient deaths because there certainly were convenient for people who did not want the truth of the assassination to come out. And what I found very interesting in researching those deaths was the grouping, okay? Right after the assassination in around Dallas, there was probably two dozen people that died under unnatural circumstances, car crashes, gunshot wounds, knifings, hanging, etc. And they were almost all, in one way or another, connected to Jack Ruby or to the Dallas underworld, and probably could have added to the knowledge about Jack Ruby's role in the assassination. And then they pardon the pun, they kind of died off. And then in the late 60s, at about the time of the Garrison investigation in New Orleans, here was another grouping of people that died off suddenly who probably could have been or would have been called to testify in that case. And then that dwindled, and we went a few years. And then about 1966, and particularly 1977, just as a whole bunch of people, including almost a dozen FBI agents and FBI officials, were going to be called to testify under oath to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, they all died off. So you have to ask yourself, you know, when does coincidence leave off and when does conspiracy begin?
Well, that's exactly right. And I guess a lot of people take the JFK assassination as a starting point for what we've the type of corruption and rot and a complete takeover of the democratic system that we've seen over the course of the last half a century. Do you say that that is a sort of starting point for what we see going on around us right now?
Oh, absolutely. I tell everyone, if you want to get into the great wide world of conspiracy, start with the Kennedy assassination, because there is so much information now available about that. In fact, actually, that's part of the problem. The cover-up in the Kennedy assassination has never been in the form of a conventional cover-up, in that we can't find out any information. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's obfuscation. It's clouding the issue with just so much facts and figures, so many charges and countercharges, claims and counterclaims, that the average person just kind of throws up their hands and goes, man, you know, I can't handle this. And they tend to forget about it. But for the astute researcher and student, if you actually go wade through that mass of information and go for the pertinent details, you can come to a pretty good understanding. For example, one of the key elements that they used to convict Oswald in the minds of the American public was the famous picture of him standing in a backyard with a rifle in one hand and a communist newspaper in the other, which was published on the cover of Life magazine in February of 1964, many months before the Warren Commission ever came out from behind closed doors and said, we conclude that Oswald did it by himself. So this was used to implant the idea that he was the assassin in the minds of all millions of Americans right off. And yet, Oswald, when he was shown that photograph by the Dallas police, he himself said, and it's right there in the Warren report back at the back, he said, well, that's my face, but that's not my body. And I know about photography, and my face was superimposed onto that photograph. And, of course, when I get a chance, I can prove that to you. And, of course, he never got the chance. So here's one key piece of evidence that has clearly been shown to be fraudulent. Another key piece of evidence was that on Monday evening following the Friday assassination, the Dallas District Attorney, Henry Wade, said to the media, oh, have I mentioned we have his fingerprints on the rifle. Well, you know, wow, his fingerprints are on the rifle. They said this was the murder weapon. I mean, that sounds like pretty conclusive evidence until you look at it more closely. And you find out that that rifle was shipped to Washington to FBI headquarters Friday night of the assassination, and on Saturday there was a document issued signed by J. Edgar Hoover himself, which says no usable prints were found anywhere on the rifle or even the inner parts of the rifle. On Sunday, the rifle, according to government documents, was shipped back to Dallas. On Monday morning, the rifle was taken over to Miller Funeral Home, where they were preparing Oswald's body for burial, and I have interviewed Paul Grudy, the funeral home director, who is now on a national radio program, said the same thing, that he was there when the FBI came into the funeral home and placed Oswald's dead hand on the rifle. And he said he had a hard time getting the fingerprint ink off of Oswald's dead hand in time for the burial. And it was that evening that they announced they'd found his fingerprints on the rifle. Now, in any fair trial, I think you would throw out that piece of evidence.
Oh, there's nothing suspicious about that. You're just being conspiracy theorist-minded. No, of course, it is so evident in so many ways. But I don't know if you saw, but last year, apparently some computer graphics researcher came out with an analysis of the backyard photos of Oswald, and he said that he had been able to reconstruct the exact angle of the sun and everything to show that these shadows were, in fact, perfectly legitimate, and they could have fallen in that way. And this was an attempt to debunk the idea that this was a fake photograph.
Right. Well, and unfortunately, Fetzer and I tore him to pieces because, you know, it's one thing to take a little plastic head and move it around however you can and get your light source just to the right place, and then you say, oh, look, the shadow falls like it does in the photograph. But the poor fellow totally ignored a myriad number of other anomalies in that photograph. For example, when you take the three known photographs of Oswald in the backyard, and there are supposedly three separate photographs taken, a few seconds, minutes apart, with a handheld camera, nothing in those photographs should actually match up perfectly, right? And they don't, except for Oswald's face. And it's the exact same in all three photographs, lending tremendous support to his allegation that somebody pasted his face on somebody else's photograph. There's many other problems. There's fingers that seem to have the fingertips missing. There's a ring in one on his hand in one photograph and not in another. The back end of the telescopic sight in one of the photographs seems to be missing. Apparently, got painted out in some way. The heights do not match. There were so many other problems with that photograph, and for that poor fellow to come out and say, "Well, I managed to get a shadow that matched the shadow in the photograph, so therefore they're legitimate photographs." The fellow just simply did not do it.
That's right, but that seems to, in fact, teach us something about the way that these types of debunkings work, is to take a tiny aspect of it and to claim that you've found some proof against that, and therefore the entire thing holds. And I think we've seen that time and again in so many different ways, including 9/11 and many other key events.
Exactly. And in fact, but here's the real problem. Now, for example, the academic who studied the backyard photograph, one photograph didn't manage to match up the shadows. I'm not going to impugn his motives because I don't know. He may have been put up to it. He may have been paid to say that, or he may have legitimately thought he had proven to himself that that must be legitimate. The problem is not his work so much as the fact that when somebody comes up with some little nitpicky piece of information and claims that they've solved the case or that this proves Oswald did it, well, the corporate mass media, they ballyhoo that all over the place. Everybody gets to see that. Everybody gets to see the headlines. Excuse me. And then later, when it's repudiated or when it's refuted and the facts are laid out, that never seems to get into the mass media. And this is what has caused so much confusion in the Kennedy assassination case. And that's why the one thing everyone can agree about the Kennedy assassination is that it is, quote, controversial, end quote. Well, it's actually not. It just appears controversial because there's such a wide gulf between those who have accepted the government pronouncements, usually supported by little or nothing, and those who have actually studied the case. And you're absolutely right about comparing this to 9/11. See, most people, especially young people who were either too young or not even born at the time of the Kennedy assassination, they don't recall or know that for about 15 years after the Kennedy assassination, up until about the time when the Zapruder film was first seen by the public, about 1975, 76, and about the time when the Church Committee announced that they had found that the CIA and the Mafia had been working together in assassination plots. But up till that time, it was just considered impolite to even talk about the Kennedy assassination in public. And I see the same thing going on today with the 9/11 attacks. You're just not supposed to talk about it. Okay, it's just too soon. We have to bind up the wounds. We have to just move on. Let's don't worry about that right now. Well, excuse me, let's not worry about it. Everything that's happening today, the crumbling of the U.S. economy, the wars that are still going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, resulting in millions of dead people, both ours, theirs, and in between, and the loss of liberty in this country, all of this is predicated on the war on terror, which is based on the attacks of 9/11. And I might mention that both of the co-chairmen of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Keene and Hamilton, and as well as their senior counsel, John Farmer, have now publicly stated that the conclusions of their own commission, the 9/11 Commission, are untrue. Well, excuse me, if it's untrue, then what's unpatriotic or inappropriate about trying to find the truth of what caused the death of 3,000 Americans.
That's right, and on the cover-up note, ABC News had a recent report about a 9/11 Truth Conference in Pennsylvania where they showed a 4 or 5 second clip of Lee Hamilton dismissing 9/11 conspiracy theories, and that was supposedly their way of debunking the claim that Hamilton and Kane had moved away from their own commission, but that's documented and on the record, so...
Exactly, but the thing is, what people don't understand the nuances, and particularly of somebody like Hamilton, who is a public figure and connected to the government, and kind of owes his livelihood and his position and his credentials to on the government. And it's one thing for him, which he has done, to question the conclusions of his own commission and say that people within the government, the FAA, the NORAD, did not give them truthful information. But it is a stretch, then, to say that he says that, you know, it was an inside job, the Bush administration caused it or something like that. That, you know, that's not true. And that gives them an out, because then they can say, well, I'm not saying that it was an inside job, and I'm not saying that, you know, the Bush people did this. No, they're not. But what they have done is call into question the official story, and if the official story is not true, then I say let's go find out what is true.
That's exactly right. And that brings up an interesting question, because from the outside, looking at a cover-up, when you identify a cover-up and you can see a cover-up as taking place, that could mean either people are covering up their incompetence or their inability to prevent the attack, or they could be covering up their complicity in that attack. And I think from the outside, both cover-ups look almost identical. Is there any identifying feature that we can use to deconstruct or to reconstruct what was taking place and why the cover-up is taking place?
Well, first off, let me say that you're absolutely right. And again, we see a parallel with the Kennedy assassination. In the wake of the Kennedy assassination, it became obvious that there were elements within the federal government of the United States that had simply not done their job, either fallen down on the protection, fallen down on the investigation, and the standard excuse was, well, they were trying to cover their butt. You know, they didn't want to look bad. And so, you know, and that is the standard explanation. And I hear the same explanation about 9/11. But there are some things about 9/11 that cannot be explained by the cover your butt theory, okay? And that is, for example, that prior to the attacks, there were people within the CIA, people within the FBI, who were trying to raise the alarm, who were trying to say, hey, we're about to be attacked, and Al-Qaeda is something we better start paying attention to. John McNeil, head of the FBI Counterterrorism Task Force, being one of them. And not only were these people ignored, and which you could write off to just, you know, inefficiency and not paying attention and on like that, but there were actually efforts made in both the Clinton administration and the Bush W. administration to block these people from making meaningful investigations. In fact, I, for one, do not think that it's just some weird coincidence that John O'Neill finally resigned as head of the terrorism task force in disgust, because he was being blocked from making a meaningful investigation, and then was offered and took a job as head of security at the World Trade Center. And he was among those lost on 9/11, one of the few people who could have told us exactly what was really going on about Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda.
Right, and there were indications that he had been set up in his FBI role. He had had a briefcase stolen at a conference, and that was used to smear him and then get him out.
And then they charged him with taking classified information.
Exactly.
It was an obvious setup.
But I've also heard the theory that he was, in fact, actually, because he was friends with Jerome Hauer, who obviously has some interesting ties to 9/11, and there is the theory that he was actually working with the conspirators, and the death aspect of that was staged in order to facilitate his role, I guess, in the attack. But I think that's a rather elaborate way of trying to get to the truth of that matter, but certainly
sounds like trying to deflect attention if he was part of the schemers and the initiators of the attack, I hardly think that he would have put himself in harm's way and, you know, walked to his death, you know, knowing that this was all going to come down like that.
Right. Well, certainly there are so many interesting aspects to 9/11 and to JFK, but we have moved on to 2010, and as we're moving further and further away from those events, it seems that the pace of these events that are taking place, it seems to me that the pace is increasing, that we're accelerating towards some sort of end point or transitionary point or something. And I don't know if that's merely my own perception, but as someone who's been researching these types of things for decades, what's your take on that?
No, I agree with you 100%. It seems like we're in a foot race. And obviously, at some level, there are people who know that something is getting ready to happen. Now, what that something is, of course, is the object of much debate, and I for one, can't tell you specifically what it's going to be, but it could be any number of things. For one thing, we see this volcano that just went off in Iceland, and they're talking about it could trigger Katla, a much larger volcano right next to it. And, in fact, that's expected to perhaps blow within the next week or so. If that should happen, that could put a volcanic ash cloud over, you know, huge portions of the northern hemisphere, which could cause just all kinds of havoc. I mean, we've already seen what can happen when all the air traffic to Europe is cut off. There's that. I mean, and, of course, you can always have a hit by an asteroid or a comet. But that's grand stuff. If that happens, I guess there's not much anybody can do about it. But there's not much. There's many other things. We see the continuing collapse of the U.S. economy, and it could be the point to where at some point they declare a bank holiday and the dollar just collapses. Now, what's that going to do to people? There could be a trucker strike, which could paralyze the entire nation. And all you have to do is just look behind the scenes at the preparations that are being made. We see that Monsanto and the Rockefeller Foundation and even Bill Gates have all gone in working with the government of Norway to complete their doomsday seed vault at Spitsbergen, Norway, which is collecting and storing in a hermetically sealed vault all of the seeds of every plant on Earth. Now, what are they getting ready for? There are rumors that there is secret space activities going on, and while we watch the rockets going off from Cape Canaveral, they're actually coming from other places using exotic new technologies and maybe preparing bases where the wealthy people could go off planet in the event of some global catastrophe, kind of as depicted in the new movie 2012, except this would not be in the movie. They are arcs that are going to go floating around on the water, and according to many sources, it's not going to be arcs in the water. It's going to be huge craft that will take people off planet. But whether that's true or not, what we also see is very scary scenarios, such as bringing a million soldiers back to the United States, placing them under the newly created Northern Command, and publicly stating that they're going to be there for crowd control and civil unrest. Which of course is a direct violation of the Posse Comitatus law, but then that seems to have been disregarded for years now anyway. That law, by the way, was there to prevent the U.S. military from policing the civilian population of the United States. But, of course, you know, 9/11, again, there were troops all over the airports and bus stations and everywhere else. So they're just ignoring that part. What's even more scary is, if you recall, back last fall, President Obama declared a national emergency over the swine flu, which turned out to be a total hoax and a big scam. And yet that national emergency has never been rescinded, to the best of my knowledge. So we're still operating under a national emergency, which means that as commander-in-chief, the president can issue any orders he wants to and can override the states and the public. So we're in a really precarious situation here, and I agree with you that it's like the velvet gloves are coming off. They're now making the people who would control the world, the secret team, whatever you want to call them, the New World Order boys, whatever, they are now apparently feeling like there is such a time crunch that they no longer have the luxury of taking two steps forward and one step back and marching steadily on towards their agenda.
Yes, and that is particularly worrying for a number of different reasons. And as you mentioned, not only the swine flu national emergency, but in fact the national emergency that was declared on September 11th has been renewed every single year by first Bush and now Obama, who renewed it last September in 2009. Yeah. So
exactly, and that's what gave Bush the rationale for throwing hundreds of people in jail without right to an attorney or without writ of habeas corpus, you know, because he said this is a national emergency. I'm in charge here. I'm the decider, and you know, they essentially are turning the once free democratic republic of the United States into a totalitarian state headed by the White House.
That's right, and you bring up another aspect of this that is also, if not equally worrying, perhaps even more worrying, and that's the Doomsday Seed Vault and what that implies for the future of the Earth, really. If the people who are in the positions that are funding the projects to create these genetic engineering technologies and are themselves creating a doomsday vault of hybrid of non-hybrid seeds and things, what does that say about what they think about their agenda and where it's heading? It's truly horrifying, I think. So what are...
I think you're right. And for those listening who might say, oh, well, no, you know, they, and many people have the idea that if something catastrophic is going to happen, you know, we'd be told about it. But I don't think that's the case. History doesn't show that's the case. In fact, you can go back to a classic science fiction movie of the early 1950s when worlds collide, and you find that it was in that movie it was discovered that a planet was going to come and crash into the Earth and destroy the Earth, and there was quite a debate at the very top of the power structure about should we tell the public, and it was decided no, they would just panic and there'll be destruction and violence and, you know, riots and you know, so let's just don't tell anybody that something like that's going to happen. And I think that would be the thinking of the people at the top of the food chain.
That's right, and if I remember correctly, that was pretty much the same discussion that was had in the recent 2012 movie when it was discovered what was happening to the planet.
Right.
Right. So
the idea that anybody's going to tell the public what's going to happen so that we can, in one way or another, prepare ourselves, that's just foolish thinking.
Well, that's right. But at the beginning of this conversation, you mentioned how the Understanding Deep Politics conference is going to be focusing on ways that people can build something constructively from this information or move forward in a positive way. So let's get a little bit into that topic, because it is easy to dwell on the negative things that are happening. But what do you see as some positive signs in recent years that might show that there is an awakening to this information happening?
Okay, number one, I would mention the Real ID Act, okay, which was passed in 2006, which mandated that all the states had to have driver's licenses that were federally approved and that had all the tape, you know, readable tape on the back and everything else. And the critics at the time said, well, this is a national ID card, you know, which many people opposed, because it's too reminiscent of the Nazis. You know, your papers, please, before you can do anything. And that law in 2006, the Real ID Act, was scheduled to go in effect in 2008. Well, 2008 came, and a majority of the states said, we're not going to do this. And it wasn't that out of any great love for individual liberty. It was simply that they said, this is going to cost too much money, and you're passing a law that says we have to do this, and yet you're not funding this. It's all going to come out of the state pockets, and we don't want to do this. So they postponed it to 2009. 2009 came, they were still saying, we're not going to do this. And here we are in 2010, and the Real ID Act still has not been put into effect. So this clearly shows that people can say no and make it stick. Another hopeful sign I see is the resolutions that have now been passed or introduced into the legislatures of perhaps 18, maybe 20 states that are called 10th Amendment resolutions. The 10th Amendment to the Constitution states that any power not specifically delegated to the federal government shall be retained by the states and hence the people. And, of course, the only two powers that are specifically given to the federal government in the Constitution is the power to coin and regulate money and to provide for the common defense. So, for example, this is going to be one of the arguments they're going to use with the Obama health care plan. So there's a number of states that are beginning to bow their back and say, we're not going to do this, all right? And this is what it's going to take. Now, of course, right now all of this is rhetoric, and push hasn't come to shove, and it's going to be very interesting, to say the least, to see what happens when the states do actually bow their necks and say, no, we're not going to go along with what you're saying. And, for example, I mean, theoretically, President Obama, under whatever pretext, could declare martial law, and the bulk of the states could go, no, we're not going to go along with that. So it's going to get real interesting because, for example, in several states, Tennessee, for one, passed a law in the state that said any firearm that's owned or purchased in the state of Tennessee is exempt from federal firearm laws. Okay, they're trying to stick with the Second Amendment. Well, of course, the gun dealers immediately queried the BATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and they said, what do we do about this? And the head of the BATF sent letters to all the gun dealers saying, ignore the state law. How do you like that? How's that for freedom and democracy? And I would also point back a few years to when the referendum in California and the majority of the voters voted to legalize medicinal marijuana. Okay, and they begin to set up these storefronts where you could go with a prescription and you could get marijuana to help the pain of cancer and AIDS, etc. And what did the federal government do? They said, oh, sorry, we still say it's against the law, and they continue to bust people in California. So it's slowly coming to a head, and of course, as you're probably well aware, James, this is nothing new. This is what the war between the states was fought about. You know, they have tried to push the idea that it was all over slavery, but slavery was never a real issue in the Civil War until maybe halfway through it with Lincoln issuing the Emancipation Proclamation. That fight was over who is going to control your destiny, you and your immediate elected officials or some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, of course, that was decided in 1865. You will do what the federal government tells you to do, and if not, they'll send federal marshals to make sure that you do it. And if that doesn't work, then they'll send the National Guard. And if that doesn't work, they'll send General Sherman and 60,000 Yankees, and they'll cut a swath through your state. So, see, that was all kind of decided, but now it's bubbling to the top again. And people, you know, no longer is it a sectional issue. Now it's nationwide, and people begin to realize that we have a real problem about, do we cave in to corrupt officials in Washington, D.C., or do we take back control of our own lives through our local and state officials?
That's right. And in that regard, of course, we see now a concerted effort in the media to attempt to demonize any protest or any opposition to the government as potential domestic terrorism. And of course, on the 15th anniversary of the OKC bombing, we've seen a lot of that type of coverage and a lot of resurgence in the hype over domestic terrorism. And we know that the possibility of a false flag provocation or even a spectacular false flag event is always there to try to marshal people back into line. What do you think about the difference between the public sentiment now in 1995, and do you think people could be so easily corralled back into line by a false flag event?
Oh, brother, that's a good question. I'm torn because the hopeful, optimistic side of me says, surely by now, people who have now, you know, in the hindsight of the Kennedy assassination and Watergate, the Iran-Contra affair, Branch Davidian massacre, the Murrah Federal Building, which, by the way, has not ever been totally solved. And if you begin to investigate the Oklahoma City bombing, you'll find that the footprints of the CIA and the military and the FBI are all over it. And then you bring it right on up. I would like to hope that people would be a little bit slower to be stampeded by another false flag event. But then on the other hand, my pessimistic left brain says, well, it's always worked before. Wiser to think it's not going to work again.
That's right. It's always worked before, and not only in American history recently, but in world history and over centuries and even millennia. So this is certainly...
Exactly. You know, you're absolutely right. In the wake of 9/11, all I could think about, because I'm a great student of Hitler and the Third Reich, was the Reichstag fire and the immediate passing of the Enabling Act, and how that false flag attack on the Reichstag, their parliament building, which by all accounts was probably set by the Nazis themselves and then blamed on the communists. It's just the parallel, same methodology. And if you've read my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, you'll find out that not only are we recycling through the same methodology, but in many instances, it's the same people in the same groups.
Exactly.
Doing the same thing. Well, if it worked once before, why not do it again?
Mm-hmm. And in fact, Hitler even had that ideology himself, not only the Reichstag fire, but then several years later, the Gliwice incident, where Polish detainees were dressed up as soldiers and then shot right up on the Polish border to justify Hitler invading Poland. So,
and, you know, that's a really good example, by the way, because all through school in my history courses, all we were taught was that Hitler started World War II by attacking Poland, okay? That's all we're told. And I think I was a grown man before I ever read about the incident there with the radio station, which was, it was a provocation. It was a false flag operation, which gave Hitler the rationale for attacking Poland. And yet that gets lost in history. And yet at the time, certainly people in Germany and probably a lot of people around the world said, well, gee whiz, they got attacked by those nasty Poles. You got to do something about it. It's just amazing. The methodology stays the same. Only the names and dates and technology changes.
But I suppose that presents us with a distinct advantage, that if we can merely show the tricks that they use to manipulate public perception, and if we can expose the parlor tricks ahead of time, then they will have less effect on the public. So getting the word out about false flag terrorism may be a way to really stop the next false flag terror event.
That's right. That's why programs such as your own is so important.
Exactly. Well, it is so important to be doing this work at this time. And as you say, that things do seem to be accelerating, and we don't know what we're heading towards, but there are many possibilities for that. And of course, one of your most recent works was on the rise of the Fourth Reich. And I'm ashamed to admit that I haven't read this book yet, but I have heard some of the interviews you've done about the work. Can you explain a little bit more about what you mean by the Fourth Reich?
Well, in essence, the Germans lost World War II. There's no question about that. But not so the Nazis. At the signing of the surrender at the end of World War II, there was nobody representing the Nazi government, the National Socialist government there. They didn't sign anything. In fact, they, about a year earlier, had instituted Operation Eagle Flight, and they had been taking everything that was worth anything out of Germany. And they created more than 1,000 corporations all around the world. And this is very important to understand, because Mussolini, the World War II dictator of Italy, is generally considered genesis for the term fascism, because fascism came from his black-shirted fascistas. And yet Mussolini himself said that fascism may not be the correct term. The more correct term is corporatism. In other words, corporate control of the state. And it's that combination of corporate and state power that is the very dictionary definition of fascism. And so the German military was defeated, but the fascist, the National Socialist, the acronym of which is Nazi in German, the Nazis went right on, in fact, were brought wholesale to the United States under Project Paperclip and other projects, and rolled into our military-industrial complex, where we not only got the benefit of their technology, but unfortunately we also got their philosophy. And this is when America began to turn into a national security state. And what's really amazing, James, is that when you go back and look, you'll find that three of the Americans who were most instrumental in helping Hitler create his Third Reich and funding the Third Reich was John J. McCloy, who is CEO of City National Bank, was the largest lender of money to Nazi Germany. His protege, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, who were attorneys for the Nazi Schroeder Bank, and Prescott Bush, who was actually prosecuted in late 1942 under the Enemy Trading with the Enemies Act as being nothing but a financial front man for Hitler and the Nazis. And it's particularly interesting then to realize that two of those men, John J. McCloy and Alan Dulles, were two of the most prominent members of the Warren Commission, which set to determine what had happened to President John F. Kennedy.
Right, and I believe it was during the Warren Commission deliberations that Alan Dulles made the famous proclamation that Americans don't read.
That's right. He said, nobody's going to read this, only a few academics. But see, that's, again, you ask, what's the good side of things? That's a good side of the thing right there. Those people back then never could have conceived that in the year 2010, grade school children would have computers. And on those computers, they could go and read every word of the Warren Commission, every word of the 26 accompanying volumes, every word of all the books and articles that have come out since tearing the Warren Commission apart, photographs that were taken then, which can now be put into the computer, digitized, blown up, and shown what was really going on, and shown if there was any doctoring going on. I'm sure it would have just boggled their mind to think that almost 50 years after the fact, there would be the technology that could see through their cover story.
Well, that's right, and that's a point that I come back to time and time again on this program, and I think my listeners will be aware by now that I do think that the internet and the incredible breakdown in the control over the dissemination of information that it represents is one of the greatest hopes that we have as a society, I think. But also, of course, it was always intended to be basically a worldwide wiretap and to be part of the surveillance society, part of the panopticon, and eventually also to be part of the transhuman agenda, whereby we start to merge with the machines. And there are negative aspects to it as well. How do you think about the warring conflict?
It was, after all, initiated by, as a military program. Yeah, exactly. And but how about this? James, do you think perhaps that the speed up of the attempt to get control of everybody might, instead of maybe some catastrophic geophysical event that would take place, which is always possible, do you think maybe that was precipitated by the unexpected and phenomenal growth of the internet? People are wising up. People are becoming more educated in the general sense, is that they know what's really going on. And perhaps these world controllers are feeling the heat and feeling the need to press forward more quickly.
I think so. I think as we've already talked about, some of their bag of tricks are starting to wear a little thin now that it's being so thoroughly exposed. And I know personally, I wouldn't have discovered 99.9% of the information that I talk about now on a regular basis on this program if it wasn't for the internet. So it's certainly been a paradigm shift in the way that we understand and the way we collect information and disseminate it to others. So I think there has to be a change in the way they're running the agenda, or there has to be an increase in what they're doing to sort of bring in the final control grid.
Right. Of course, it's a double-edged sword. Not only, though, is it giving us information, but let us never forget that there is a delete key on the computer keyboard. And I've already run into several instances where I have gotten what I consider very sensitive information. And when I go back and try to track it in the Internet, all of a sudden it's page not found, server not found, you know. So you can take, that's why I'm an inveterate pack rat when it comes to paper, hard copy, you know, books, magazines, things you can actually hang on to. Because I learned way back there from old editors, well, how do you know this? Well, I read a book. What book? Well, if I don't have the book, then it's just my word against theirs. But if I've got the book, I can say, here it is, it's right here. Oh, okay. So I've held on. I think it's very important that we continue to warehouse hard copy, because the thing that concerns me is the day that could come when everything's in the computer and then, oops, it's gone away. And if you think that's far-fetched, just consider that that was actually one of the foundations of the 1948 book, 1984, by George Orwell. Winston Smith, the protagonist, his job was to work for the Ministry of Truth and to sit at essentially a computer. It was a screen and had a keyboard and all this stuff. And he would, every day he would go in and look at the latest government pronouncements and then go back into the archives and the files and delete, erase anything that didn't correspond to the latest official line.
That's right. And it is so worrying to see such incredibly important information already starting to disappear from the Internet. And I go back to articles that were even only a few years old, and already the videos have been deleted or the articles can no longer be found. So that's why I always urge people to download and save to your hard drive any story that you think is particularly important. But even more fearsome than that, I think, is the idea of virtual flag terrorism, which Webster Tarpley has recently been talking about, and it certainly, to my mind, seems to be one of the biggest threats right now, is whereby in the cyber terror world, they'll be able to commit any act whatsoever and then blame it on anyone anywhere in the world and say that it was a hacker in Russia or China and use that as a provocation to start a war. And it really is, it's truly frightening to think how the public may be willing to fall for that more than some spectacular 9/11 type event.
Right, and even on a personal level, it's pretty scary, because, just for example, what if the powers that be decided that James Corbett is creating a big problem and they can't find out anything else on you? How easy would it be to have a hacker plant child pornography on your computer, bust you, and then announce to the world that you're this huge child pornographer, and all of society would turn their back on you, and you're gone, and nobody's going to listen to you anyway? I mean, that's incredible amount of power that you've got through the technology.
Exactly. The technology can be used either to liberate us or to even further enslave us, and in ways that's not even very obvious. So that's something that I think people have to be aware of and keep in mind. Well, Jim Marrs, an incredible conversation, but I guess wrapping up here, let's talk once more about the conference and give people some details about how they can come and see you speak in person.
Well, the conference itself is Understanding Deep Politics, and this is over the weekend of May the 14th, 15th, and 16th at the University Inn and Conference Center in Santa Cruz, California. And as you mentioned earlier, I'm going to be on the roster with several prominent political science investigators, researchers, some of which are definitely on my hero list. For example, Barry Swicker and Peter Dale Scott, Michael Prenti, they're on my heroes list, and others like David Ray Griffin. I've interviewed David, and I have the highest regard for him. He seems to be a very moral and upright man. And we've got Ellen Brown, Ian Crane, Annie Macon, Cynthia McKinney, Peter Phillips. It's going to be quite a lineup. And like I said, I think the thing that's going to be the most enlightening, the most uplifting about this is that rather than just recite the foibles and the ills that are manifesting in our society today, I think we're all going to try to take a look and say, see, you know, well, what can we really do about this? What can be done to make the United States a better place and to restore the constitutional republic that we were given to by our forefathers?
That's right. And people who are interested in that conference can go to understandingdeeppolitics.org for more information about it. And how about your own website? Where can people go to get more information about you?
Okay. Oddly enough, jimmars.com. And that's Mars with two R's, M-A-R-R-S. You can get my books at a discount through the website. Plus, I try to post from time to time articles that you probably will not be able to see in your mainstream corporate media. Plus, just anything else that comes up. I recently started a community, or I guess it's kind of a forum, where people, like-minded people, can get together and can discuss the issues of the day. In fact, as kind of an enticement to get people to come to the new forum, I did place there my article on the alien ghost in Roswell, New Mexico. And I totally understand how bizarre and woo-woo that sounds, but read the piece, read the interviews with the people in the hospital, read the research that shows that where these hauntings have been reported is the exact location of the old Army Air Force Hospital there at Roswell, which, by according to the story, is where they took dead alien beings back in 1947. Anyway, it's simply a presentation of facts and information, and I'll let people draw their own conclusions. But it's a heck of a story, and it's available on my community at jimmars.com.
Well, that is not my area of expertise, but I have absolutely no doubt that that you have a well-documented and researched piece about that, and I am looking forward to reading that and some of your other books as well. I'm such a late comer to the Jim Mars phenomenon, but I'm glad I'm here now. So absolutely,
well,
I hope I can get you back on the program in the future.
Be sure and read The Rise of the Fourth Reich. That's going to give you a whole new view on many things, including the Kennedy assassination. And I better put in a plug while I can, because I don't know if we'll talk before the end of June. But at the end of June, I've got a new book coming out from HarperCollins entitled The Trillion Dollar Conspiracy, How the New World Order, Man-Made Diseases, and zombie banks are destroying America.
That sounds absolutely fascinating, and I would be honored to have you back on to talk about that when it comes out. So I look forward to talking to you then.
Me too, and I appreciate it. Thanks, James.
Thank you very much.